Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining me today on the Class War Battlefield podcast. Please do me the honor of supporting this work that I am doing. I've been doing this work now for free on your behalf for, my God, 11 years. 5, 10, 20, 50. If you can afford it, please do. Cash at me at $CWBpodcast. CWBpodcast. Cash App it. CWBpodcast. Also, hit me up on PayPal, CWB Podcast, all the way across the board, y'all. Help me out. Thank you for donating, and enjoy the show. Class War.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
My attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no war, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When the system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield podcast episode. I am your brother, Vimeer Deese. Oh, Gaia. There is something interesting happening presently in this world. It is something that the right wing seems very encouraged by. And it is something that the Democrats seem willing to take advantage of. And that is the decline of what is called the white race. Now, obviously, clearly, there has been many books written over the last 50 years predicting the decline of the United States. But there is now a subset genre from that topic, which really has started narrowing its gaze onto 2030s for a time period when that fall will reach the ground. I think from the standpoint of previous very thorough examinations of what is called Western civilizations, societies that have collapsed, and in some instances non-Western civilization societies that have collapsed, the United States is very much on the road to some sort of political, social collapse in the coming 20 years. Now, rather that will be a social, political collapse that will literally throw the domestic society into chaos, which is a possibility. Or it'll be a social political collapse that just impacts its outer regions, the empire it has subdued over the past, 200 years. Will be seen, once when it occurs. presently, the arguments in Congress, and to call them arguments is generous. I'm recording this about, what, a week or so, not even that, from the State of the Union. And it's worse than I ever thought it would be. For those of you listening in the future, but it is worse than I ever thought it would be. But the arguments being supposedly had really focus around how quick the degradation of, or maybe not degradation, the fulfillment of those collapse prophecies will occur. Now, obviously, clearly, only I think the Republicans are keenly aware of what they are doing with their arguments. They are trying to create a corporate-friendly, social-political environment. Now, I didn't include economic there because corporations, by their very nature and their very creation, are economic entities. The social-political parameters necessary for corporations to exist is variant, and they're wide. You can have a socialist social-political structure for your society and still have corporations. You could have a fascist, as was the case with Germany and Italy and many of the regimes that the United States and West Asia, y'all know them as Europe, but it's not really a continent, it's a part of a continent, that they supported post-World War II during the decolonization period. You can have either one of these structures running rampant over your social-political life, especially domestically, and still have corporations everywhere. But when you allow a corporation to dictate the terms for your social political life, that is actually very dangerous. And we know this because the United States and most of the world did this. This was the for the United States, this was the post-Civil War years. The 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, 1900s, 1910s, 1920s, and then there's this thing that happened in the U.S. and throughout the world called the Great Depression. And the long belief, the long-held belief that corporations are sacrosanct, that they alone, particularly the people who owned them, understood what they were doing on a social political level. That not only was challenged significantly, but it was essentially thrown away because evidence from the previous 50, 60 years had said, no, they have no clue what they're doing. They're just winging it and making as much money as they could. The greed was the problem. Remember in the 80s, greed is good. Greed, for a lack of a better word. The better word that Michael Douglas's character, what was it, Gecko? I can't really remember his name. But what he was trying to think of was evil. Was evil. You call it greed, I call it evil. It distorts you terribly. You lose your humanity when you are greedy. It's a rough go about it all. this reality, which conservative Republicans and Republicans in general seem hell-bent on creating, in and of itself, promises extensive social political collapse. Why? Because, and this was seen in the late 1800s and the early 1900s, in order for corporations to, as a lot of people like to say, thrive, please look up the word rive, R-I-V-E. It's actually a word. And I had heard it before. Actually, I'd read it before in a book. And I didn't necessarily know what it meant. So I looked it up. Because rive is the core word to thrive. And once you read what rive, R-I-V-E, means, it changes your use of the phrase thrive. In order for corporations to thrive, and I cannot own responsibility for coming up with this next piece. I can't remember who I heard first talk about this, but I've heard this idea bantied around over the last 13, 14 years. In order for corporations to thrive, they necessarily attach themselves to the life force of a community and slowly rip it apart. And the culture for a corporation has to slowly rip these things apart, because the only way that you encourage people to buy things they don't need is you have to make them feel empty. And by the way, in case it wasn't clear when I said the life force of a community, I am not talking about the individual. I'm talking about the family unit and the extended family unit, including friends and colleagues and acquaintances, all of that. Because see, when you have a deep, abiding love for each other, and there's a camaraderie there that mandates, in order for you to feel good about yourself, in order for you to feel comfortable about what you are producing in life, the others around you must feel good also. I know for a lot of Republicans, the corporate conservatives who are Republicans, this is just a socialistic concept, but it's not. This is literally human nature. This is how humanity was able to survive in the hunter-gatherer stage of life. When you have that abiding love for each other, that camaraderie-ship that says they must do well as in order for me to do well. When, even at the outskirts of community, evil is ripping apart families. Evil is ravaging the prosperous fruitfulness of the work that people are doing. You, even though you are away from it, even though you are away from it, cannot stand silent. Nor could you stay put. You have to fight it, and not just with words. You have to fight it with everything you have, because you know if that thing is ravaging the edge of the town, if it's ravaging five families over from you, you know if it gets through those five, it ain't going to stop with you. So you start to fight it over there. Which leads me to my next topic. Terrorism. Recently, we saw the idea of Cop City down in Atlanta move forward. Most people are not discussing why Cop City is being built. And I think it is doing a disservice to the project not to discuss why it's being built, because it is tied into the destruction that these Republican conservatives are aiming to create. Cop City is being established. And I thought it was hilarious when the buck dancing mayor said of the worries of the environmentalists who literally have said you're tearing down a public forest to build what is essentially, let's be honest, ladies and gentlemen, this is a domestic law enforcement base of operations. Base of operations. Let's be very clear about that. This is akin to a civilian military base. It is stunning, the breadth of it. It is stunning, the breadth of it. But the mayor said, when talking about the environmental concerns of the people who are squatting there, who are doing their thing to try to protect that space, and I love the white sheriff or chief or whoever he was, who came in after the mayor to really show who was pulling the strings, to really show that this was a white Atlanta suburb and Georgia project that was imperial in nature. We have to control the colonials. They're getting a little bit out of hand. But he said, and I couldn't tell if he was being for real or not, because Lord, actually I'm lying. If you're black, you know when you see a buck dancer in front of you. And I listened to what he said, and I'm like, dude, you don't even believe what you're saying. Your words are coming out of your mouth, but you know what you're saying sounds stupid. Well, I mean, the money's good. At least they're paying you good. I mean, if you're going to be in a brothel, you might as well get paid good for it. So yeah, that's what he's doing. But anyway, so when addressing the environmental concerns, he said, oh, well, my administration has done, you know, just yeoman's work with when it comes to protecting the environment. And then he clarified. He didn't say yeoman, by the way, but, you know, he wanted to press his white overlords. Then he clarified. We have established X amount of, great green spaces and parks and, wait a minute, a park is not the same as, and we have established X amount of new green spaces for recreation and, but that is not the same as a natural forest. Why didn't you allocate those places, which, by the way, I bet you a number of them were reclamation projects. Why didn't you allocate some of those new green spaces that you probably reclaimed? Why didn't you put those spots up for Cop City? Now, obviously, I know why he ain't do that. And the reality is, I don't want him to do it. Cop City, like I said, it's a civilian military base for law enforcement. And as I said before, the idea behind law enforcement is to enforce a Darwinist law and an imperial law. When they say they protect and they serve, well, yeah, they do protect and they do serve. They protect the privilege, they serve the privilege. And who are the privilege? It's quite amazing that for years, when I talked about that, it was like, oh, it's the wealthy. But who else do we say have privilege? The Imperials themselves. And for those of you who are not familiar, the Imperials are white people. Now, granted, look, I know what some of y'all are saying. There are white people there. Those folks are on the outskirts of Imperium. And they are as hated as the colonials, if not a little bit more, because, see, those are traitors. And as a white Nazi former friend of mine once told me, you know, the only thing that I hate worse than a nigga is a goddamn white traitor. Blow all of their heads away. Like, well, don't worry. You'll get your wish someday, I imagine, because you're that kind of a guy. But when I said to him he'll get his wish someday, he said, well, good. I'm good. I go, well, you misread me, man. You misread me, because you calling violence into action against people who are doing the right thing, it's coming back on you. It's coming back on you. So far as I know, he hasn't had the pleasure of being dispatched from this planet. But, and he's the type of person who would look at that as a pleasure, because he thinks he's going to heaven. And, man, that's going to be a hell of a look on his face when he realizes there ain't a hell, but there is this place. And since you're so confident about what exists and what doesn't, when you go to that place, that's your doing. Booyah. Anyway. On the other side of the aisle, when it comes to the decline of the race, because, well, I suppose I probably should finish up with the Republicans, because their response to the decline of the race is these culture wars, is the culture wars. But on a deeper level, and I guess it's not even on a deeper level, because they've really started amplifying this. You know, a couple of years ago, I started saying I was a conservative, and I started promoting the fact that a lot of black people are conservative. And, you know, after George Floyd died, that took on a whole new meaning. Republicans, who are getting slammed for the lack of diversity within their ranks, suddenly started finding black conservatives everywhere. Everywhere. And look, there's always been black conservatives, but there are different types of conservatism, as I've mentioned before, and these black conservatives are, in many instances, especially to the community that they supposedly belong to, because most of them have not belonged to the community for quite some time, they are traitors. They are not people who are trusted. GOP congressman, the black GOP congressman, Byron, or I don't even know his name. Anyway, he applied to join the Congressional Black Caucus and was angered by the fact that the Congressional Black Caucus told him to kick rocks, step off. And I saw black conservatives online talking trash about this. And I didn't try to reason with them, because I've tried to reason with black conservatives before. And their minds are as limited as their white counterparts. I knew why the Congressional Black Caucus told him to kick rocks. Because most black conservatives, especially those that were not present in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, who understood the difference between black conservatism and white conservatism, who wasn't pulled up by their bootstraps by white people to make them feel like they're better than their community, because that's what white conservatives do. They make you feel, as a black conservative, that you're better than your community, that you know more, that your intentions are greater and better than liberals. I have many issues with liberals, but that's just nuts. I really think on most accounts, liberals and conservatives do equal damage to the black community, but it's what it is. And that you are definitely better than the radicals, who traditionally have had the greatest impact because their ideas were more outside of the box. They could see through institutional stagnation, and they can implement things that were really going to elevate the community instead of just giving power over to the institutions, which is a problem with liberalism. Liberalism is more institutional than radicalism. So, the attempt by him to join the CBC was denounced because they couldn't trust him. Not only could they not trust him, they shouldn't have trusted him. Looking at him, he appeared on Joy Reid, and listening to him talk, this black Republican congressman, he sounded exactly like white Republicans. All of his answers were scripted just like theirs. It was all about the talking points. There was nothing that he said that wasn't prepared for him by his handlers. He couldn't think outside of what those white marionette controllers were telling his brain to say. That makes him a danger to the CBC. And I'm not even a big fan of the CBC, who have turned very hardcore liberal capitalists in the past 40 years with very little to show for it. With very little to show for it. But this man is a robot and would sell out the CBC. And look, forget about he would sell out the CBC for his masters. He was literally a plant. That's what he was there for. That's what he was there for. That's the point. The Republicans have learned, as the race continues to decline, mostly due to birth rate, but there are other factors too, including the fact that white people are really engaged in a struggle against knowledge, especially the middle of the country. They are dead set on a lot of them, not all of them, tearing down institutions that would elevate especially young people's lives so that they could be, as these conservative capitalists keep saying, competitive with other people outside of the country. Man, that's a hell of a, that's a thing that we don't even talk about, the insanity of how they are stripping like public education of its funds and things like that, when that is what is needed to make American children competitive with children in China, children in Japan, children in a rising power that a lot of people don't realize will be there in Africa and elsewhere. But, I don't want to get off on that because I will, I have about a good 20 minutes on that one. How dumb competition is and how conservatives really do not believe in competition, or else they wouldn't be doing the things that they are doing. Granted. On a granular class level and social community level, a lot of these conservatives that are talking this game of competition are millionaires, tens of millionaires, decamillionaires, and billionaires. They are building institutions to ensure that their children are at least good general managers of the system that they're leaving behind. And because the society is changing, the race of the society, or not the race, but the color of the society is changing, they know that in order to really try to hold on to power, they have to insert black and brown faces into their mix, even if those black and brown faces don't think for themselves. The same can be said about the Democrats. With the election of who constantly looks purple to me, Jeffries. I mean, the dude really, like, I've seen multiple pictures of the guy, and every single time I see him, he looks like a different shade of purple or blue or what have you. Now, you might be like, well, that seems like a problem of your computer. It seems like a problem of your TV. One, I don't have a TV. Two, you know, that would be true. I would believe that this was a problem of my computer or my phone, but I don't see anybody else looking that way. I don't. Hakeem Jeffries, for me, is similar to, he holds some of the similar problems of some black conservatives. And the reason for this is because, look, Hakeem Jeffries was picked to do what he's doing because they know, because white people, especially Nancy Pelosi, who ran a tight shift and who was the queen of the Congress, she knows he's going to uphold the white values that undergird, the white capitalist values that undergird the foundation that her and her liberal friends helped to construct since the 1970s. The problem with those white capitalist principles is that they took into account no lessons that were learned during the Great Depression. All they took into account was what corporations wanted them to take into account. Moreover, those white capitalist principles, we have seen now for 50 years, has resulted in the impoverishment of a nation. Hakeem Jeffries has already signaled, and hopefully he's just playing everybody, but the dude don't look like a guy who's playing everybody. Nancy Pelosi, I don't believe, would put somebody forward who she thought was playing everybody. No, this person had to be beholden to the same forces that she was beholden to, dancing to the same tune that she was dancing to, and willing, and absolutely willing, to keep the Democratic Party as it has been for much of the last 30 years, an exclusive club. Hakeem Jeffries has already declared war on anything that is beyond, forget about left of center, center of center. And he's done it by working with Zionist groups. I know we ain't supposed to talk about it. Jewish people don't do anything wrong. I get it. But these groups have already meddled in black politics, and he has signed off on it. He has already signaled that he will allow, without any type of pushback, corporate PACs to go into, and not only just Democratic corporate PACs, he will allow GOP corporate PACs, he will partner with GOP corporate PACs to go into primaries where progressives are winning. People with a Democratic socialist leaning are winning. And he would not only partner with the GOP, but he will partner with corporations to try to take those people down. He has signaled that. And not just signaled it, he has done it. The Democratic Party, in the past 5 years, specifically since George Floyd died, and since they started getting pushback from not only one generation, but now two generations who essentially are saying, you're not going to live forever, get the hell out the way before we run you over. Which is going to happen sometime in between 2026 and 2032, by the way. But they recognized that they had to do something to appease what was a storm coming. And their response to the decline of the white race was to place people like Hakeem Jeffries in positions of power. What has this meant for the party? Nothing yet. Nothing yet. I mean, it's kind of interesting to me, right? And I didn't even think about this, and I forgot who was talking about it. I think it was Rational National, but don't quote me on that. What this has meant for the party, again, nothing yet, but I do think the party has become more dominated by one force, by the individual person at the top. Now, of course, people say, well, yeah, but that's all. That's how it's always been. It's always been, you know, one person calling the shots. No. You had coalitions and not just caucuses, because like the Progressive Caucus is infiltrated by a ton of corporatists who hate progressives. No, you had multiple centers of gravity, which the speaker had to contend with. And what that did was that allowed a variable of legislation to pass through not only committees, but it allowed a variable of legislation to pass through the House. And when the Senate was arranged the same way, it allowed a variable of legislation to pass through the Senate. Ever since, essentially, vain, self-centered individuals who grew up in a society that was built by New Deal efforts, by radical efforts prior to the New Deal that put pressure on the Roosevelt administration, ever since the generation with the greatest wealth transfer to them on a familial basis, on a communal basis, on a state basis, on a societal basis, on a continent and country basis, so on a domestic basis altogether. Ever since the greatest wealth transfer ever to occur in human history was given to them, they literally believed that the world was theirs because they had earned it. I'll never forget Dave Hoffman, three years ago, I think, published that a really great interview on his YouTube channel. Older guy, older brother, who has been a documentary filmmaker for 50 plus years. And it was of Depression era parents. No, I'm sorry, not Depression era parents. Baby boomer era parents. And they talked about that. How detached a lot of the children were from understanding how the home worked, how things happened for them every day. And the father observed, mother might have too, I'm sorry if I don't remember correctly, that this actually created this kind of split in reality of feeling like they had accomplished stuff when they hadn't accomplished anything, feeling like they were owed stuff when they didn't understand how they got the stuff in the first place. And when I look at how the Congress on both levels, at both levels, the House of Representatives, the Senate, how they've evolved, I see this there. I see this there. And in fact, I think it was when I was listening to Dan Carlin's Death Throes of a Republic, which is a really condensed telling of the fall, like the final 100 years of the Roman Republic as it fell into the Roman Empire. When I was listening to him, and then later it was confirmed when I listened to a new podcast, which went through an extensive amount of Roman history called the History of Rome podcast, one of the greatest podcasts I have ever listened to. That's when I saw the correlation. One of the biggest issues that even with Rome, that these societies all seem to have is hyper-extending themselves, bringing in far too much money, and not having a plan, a clear plan, to use it in a way where it doesn't corrupt the culture. Now, I'm not saying that a culture can't have money. Far from it. But see, these young people of Nancy Pelosi's age, of Chuck Schumer's age, who I think might be just slightly a little bit younger than her, they grew up in a time period where they didn't have to necessarily do the things that just one generation ago children of their age had to do. And here, I'm not just talking about working. I'm talking about the hard labor of maintaining a house that was the reality for most people in early 1900. In you know, the 1910s. In the 1920s. By the time the 1950s came, while homes were not all fitted for electricity and things like that, life was speedily increasing and improving, should I say. So increasingly improving. That changes people. I mean, when you aren't having to fetch water every day, what do you do at that time that you would have been fetching water? When you aren't having to always raise food, what do you do with the time that you could be raising food? I actually would argue that all of that domestic chore time, which in the 50s, for a lot of families in the early 60s, absolutely evaporated. Meaning they had a ton of leisure. I actually argued this in my early episodes, which today would be called segments because they were that short. They became radicalized because that's what had happened during the previous generation. When you had leisure time, you fought to make the society better. That didn't happen with the next generation after them. So after the baby boomers, that didn't happen with the baby boomer, with the, I think it was Generation X afterwards. And then my generation. Why? Now, my generation tried to do it, but we were beaten down for it. That's where the idea, again, of grunge music came from, the dispossession that was undertoning gangster rap music, all of that stuff. It didn't happen, though, because by the time Generation X came along, by the time my generation came along, this society was a vastly different society. The leisure time that had been available to the baby boomers was leisure because they didn't spend time in front of the computer. They didn't spend time in front of the TV. They spent time in front of the radio and hanging out outside. They also spent time in institutions which didn't scalp them every day of the year. So they had time to live. By the time my generation particularly came of age, and increasingly the generation behind mine came of age, they would have been coming of age in the late 80s and the early to mid 90s. The idea of working and not having enough money to take care of the necessities of life was not just a reality. It was the rule. And I posited way back in 2011, might have been early 2012, but I think it was 2011, that this was by design. There was an attempt, there was a mandate, should I say, to create a society to deprive a newer generation from having the same luxury as the baby boomers, which was to contemplate a better world and to have the time to try and implement it. I stand by that proposition. So, let me get this thing finished up here. As the white race in this country does decline, and again, it's mostly due to birth rate declines. It's mostly due to a culture in the United States that was never set. I mean, white folks talk a good game about American culture, but American culture was really rooted in a few principles. Militarism, it had to be, by the way, rooted in militarism, because they were conquering new lands. They were displacing people. They were enslaving others, which brings me to the next principle, exploitation. The American culture is rich in exploitation. Rich in exploitation. Capitalism's whole story is of exploitation. Dominionism. Hey, hate the religious right all you want, but they tell the truth sometimes. And they are telling the truth about their concept of dominionism. They went across the land, capturing the land because they said that they had a right to do so. They had a right to use it for whatever they wanted and to treat it however they wanted. They also America also works using the principle of revision. The idea of not on revision is interesting, right? It's an idea that is about writing a more favorable history for the conquerors. But it is also, and we see this constantly, and I think CRT is explained by it, there is a delusionary or aspect to it, which is required for the conqueror to sleep at night, especially in an increasingly humanistic world. If you, by dint of genocide, extraordinary extermination of a people's and the enslavement of another people, built your wealth. And you built that wealth even when you said that you didn't build it that way. You continued building it through the same means, except for maybe less extermination, but you called the enslavement something else, Jim Crow. As the world turns against such actions, you have to have a response to that. And the response was delusionary for America. It also worked and works on the principle of oligarchic rule. I don't need to really explain that. Even though I contemplated for some time talking about the fact that America seems to work on the principle of fascism. But fascism is, I think, there needs to be deep study about how fascism intertwines with republicanism as envisioned by the Romans. I still contend that this country's primary political economic system based on what the Romans was, or utilized, is Republican, and that Republicanism, based on what the Romans themselves utilized to represent Republicanism, is inherently fascistic generating. But, you know, reasonable people can differ. And ultimately, and I will look, I'll give Tom Hartman some credit for this. I've thought long and hard. And you might even see it on a couple of the podcast episodes that I still have to publish. I fought long and hard on the idea that America was a democracy. Well, to an extent, yes, America is a democracy, and America does work with democratic principles. The reason I say to an extent is because the Greeks viewed democracy significantly different than Americans view democracy. They believed that the people at the top of the society were the cream of the crop, they were the smartest people, and they should have really to right, not only the right to rule, but to right to debate and offer great oratory. The people below them didn't necessarily have that right. Yes, they could go, they could listen to them speak and all of that, but the people below them didn't really have a lot of say-so in how things happened. They voted just like the Romans did, but if the wealthy didn't want to really take what they said, you know, as gospel truth, they didn't have to. And I think the last principle that goes into Americanism is despiritualization. This is something that an elder from our community, Dr. Obatashaka, has really helped me to appreciate. There is a huge despiritualized nature within this country. I remember some years back hearing Morris Berman talk about this same concept, reading about it in his book. Which one was it? I think it was volume 2 of his, or book 2 of his, I can't believe I'm completely flaking on that. And that was a book that really shocked me, man. And I can't think of the name of it. So sorry about that. Anyway. So, yeah, I guess that's it. So, if you have any questions, comments, concerns, you know, you can always reach out to me. Again, I implore all of you, please help support this this podcast. I would really like to make this the first year that I put out 50 of these or more. Cash App me, CWB Podcast, CWB Podcast, that's my Cash App. For PayPal, CWB Podcast there also, just right across the board. I have to look into Venmo to maybe get on there also. But look, ladies and gentlemen, again, help me support this. 5, 10, 20, make it every month. My goal really is by this autumn to be making enough, which on the lower end is $3,000 a month. On the more middling end would be $6,000 to $10,000. And what do I plan on doing with that? One, it'll give me the opportunity to do this full time. The $3,000 a month will give me the opportunity to do this full time. I will then be dedicated to putting out at least once every week one of these episodes. I will also be able to start putting together more well thought out and structured podcasts. I may not do it directly under CWB Podcast, but I will do it. Number two, if I move towards the 6 to 10,000, here's what I'll be able to do with that. This is my plan. One, I'll be able to start donating money to other podcasts. I'll commit to at least, you know, with the 6,000, I could commit to at least a few hundred dollars every month. Why do I say a few hundred dollars? Maybe $300, maybe four, maybe five. It is because I'm going to use the rest of it to gain access to some resources. There are multiple databases that I want to gain access to, but I need the money to do it. Most of those databases are $100 a month. Some of them are as much as $300 a month. Now, I don't necessarily need to gain access to those all the time, but I worked with a couple of these databases when I was in college. When you have full access to them, you have access to huge, huge libraries of magazines and newspapers and like that go back over 100 years. So, and granted, you know, I could do one by one each newspaper, but I would save money having access at least to two of them. Additionally, I'll be able to put some significant money into SEO marketing. That is just a strategy to distribute the podcast more so I could reach more people. I may even be able to, especially as I move towards that $10,000 plus a month level, I may be able to then start to do some serious contemplation on partnering up with people, things like that. But I got to get there. Usually it's a 2-year to 3-year process to get to the, you know, $3,000 to $6,000 range. I am asking all of you, 5, 10, 20 plus dollars a month. Commit to it. Help me make this permanent. Help me make this permanent. I'd love to, in the next 6 to 12 months, get to a point where I can put out between 4 to 8 of these episodes a month. Now, here's the funny thing, family. I already, when I am really feeling this podcast, when I have the extra energy, I'm not working all the time, or I'm not, like, you know, working to a point where I'm exhausted at the end of the day, I record enough of these. I have recorded enough of these in years past to produce 6+ episodes per month. But I didn't have the time to get them edited, to get them put together so that you could listen to them. I actually counted, and I know this is quite long, so I apologize for that, but I counted, I think it was 2017. 2017, back at the in early 2018, I counted. I actually recorded like 74 episodes. And think about the number of episodes that I released. 2018, it was down significantly. Got sick in the beginning of the year. But 2019, again, I had like 60-something episodes. 2020, again, I had 60-something episodes. But I didn't have the time to put them out. I know you're like, well, wait, 2020 was lockdown. Yeah, I worked at a place that handled medical equipment. I didn't stop working. So, please support the show. CWB Podcast. You can either Cash App it. Don't forget, when you do the Cash App, hit that $ before it. Cash App, CWB Podcast. PayPal it the same way. CWB Podcast, PayPal. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you can always reach out to me. I love hearing from you. Until the next one, peace. On the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio talk shows and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone.